Anyway, this is May 8th, isn't it, or 9th?
May 9th, yes, sir.
1996, and I'm recording with Cameron Randall, who is, what is your official title with Arista?
Vice President and General Manager of Arista Texas.
Maybe we can start. You can tell me, I was talking to Carrie earlier before you arrived. Arista actually has a parent company, is that correct?
Right. Arista Texas is actually an outgrowth of Arista Nashville, which is, as you would expect, a country division of Arista Records. Mm-hmm. And Arista in Nashville is a very, very young corporation by comparison to other record labels in Nashville. It was established for the recording and the promotion of country music. I believe 1988 was the first year. And I was actually on hand for the grand opening of Arista Nashville, headed up by a gentleman named Tim Dubois.
This is in 88?
In 88.
Tim, how old were you, 10 years old?
No. Thank you very much. Hardly. Tim Dubois was a CPA and accounting professor at Oklahoma State University and at the University of Tulsa. He was an auditor, Federal Reserve Bank auditor in Dallas, for several years as well in the 70s, when he got the bug to be a songwriter. He had a wife and two children and said, I want to pick up from my accounting career. And he was just a couple of hours shy of a doctorate in accounting. Has a master's and a CPA, and just a couple of hours shy, and was at the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas working as an auditor when he was very influenced by Texas music, particularly music coming out of Austin during that time. That was the time of the Cosmic Cowboys.
Yeah.
You know, Doug Somm and Jerry Jeff and, Michael Martin Murphy, all those artists. So he picked up his family, moved to Nashville, and was an accounting professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and began the songwriting, what initially was a lark, and eventually turned into a very successful, very lucrative career as a songwriter in Nashville, who happened to have this extensive background in accounting. He then went into artist management, and in 1988, when Clive Davis, who was a legendary record man in New York, he was previously the head of Columbia Records for many years. Clive Davis left Columbia and in 1975 created Arista Records. His first artist was Barry Manilow.
What
tremendous success from day one. Clive Davis is the man who signed and discovered Whitney Houston, among others. On the label now are artists like Aretha Franklin and Carly Simon, some of the major divas in pop music. Well, Clive Davis decided in 87 and 88 that he wanted to extend Arista's reach into country music. So he established Arista Nashville, and he called on Tim Dubois, who had by that time become a successful songwriter, artist manager, who had this background in accounting, to head up Arista Nashville. Well, if you fast forward a little bit, about 1990 and 1991, I was an artist manager in Nashville and had put together a group called Texas Tornadoes, whom I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
And between working with Freddie Fender and Flaco Jimenez, Doug Somm, Augie Myers, I got very much in touch, with what we were calling Tex-Mex music, which obviously had been Chicano music and Tex-Mex music. And it was at a Flaco Jimenez show in Houston in 1991.
Let me stop you. I just want to make sure that you are exactly... Sorry about the introduction.
No problem. The Flaco Jimenez show at the Tower Theater in Houston, which was in 1990 or 91. I think it was 1990. I went in with Flaco, and we did a morning show, a Telemundo talk show, and Emilio Nevada was on the talk show.
This is 1990?
1990, and I'd never heard of Emilio. I'd never heard of Tejano music. But I was accompanying Flaco to the show, met Emilio, was very impressed with the look and with his whole demeanor, the discussion that took place on the talk show about the burgeoning popularity of Tejano music. And they asked me, Emilio and the folks with him asked me if I was tuned into Tejano music. And my response as an Anglo was, well, I know Tex-Mex, You know, I'm not sure exactly what Tejano is. They encouraged me to come to the show early and see Emilio's performance that night. And, you know, we're often prevailed upon when you're on the road to see opening acts. And you seldom are able to do that because you've got so much going on with the headline artists and so much business to contend with. But something, you know, was real intriguing about Emilio and that whole discussion that morning. And I said, sure, I'll come check that out. So I did go early. And I saw an audience packed to the brim with young Latinos. And all the guys were in...
This is in Houston.
This is in Houston. And all the guys were in Wranglers and had starch shirts, you know, and resist all hats. And the girls were, you know, in Rocky Mountain jeans. And, you know, it was to for someone who had been an Anglo working in country music in Los Angeles and in Nashville, what I saw was a mirror image of the young country audience, which was fueling, you know, the resurgence of country music out of Nashville. And I saw a mirror image of that that reflected in the, you know, through the Latino culture. Flaco obviously was on the older end of the spectrum, and the conjunto music
Do the hat and all that stuff.
No, the conjunto music I came to see was the artists like Flaco and Santiago and those guys are perceived in a fashion similar to the way artists like Merle Haggard and George Jones and Buck Owens are perceived by the country community, and that is there is a tradition of respect and appreciation bordering on reverence in some instances. And yet, the contemporary market, and this is, you know, an important market discussion, the contemporary market is fueled not by those older artists, regardless of the respect that's shown for them, but by the younger audience, and, you know, as buyer, and they respond to the younger artist. So I saw, you know, a lot of similarities between the country world and the Tejano world, and I was hooked from that moment. So I took Emilio. I became Emilio's manager within a year.
He was still relatively unknown in 1990.
He had just left Ram. You know, he'd been working, not Ram, I'm sorry, he'd just left David Legarza, where Ram Herrera had been before, and was on his own and had been recording for EMI Latin exclusively for all recordings. However, he had only been recording in Spanish. He had only been doing Tejano recordings.
Right.
And had for some time wanted to branch out and become a country artist. So I was a fan of Emilio, completely fascinated by Tejano music and convinced that there was a growing market for Tejano music. At the time, we were managing Texas Tornadoes, a country band on the West Coast called Desert Rose Band, which was a seminal West Coast group, included an artist named Chris Hillman, who was a founding member of the rock group The Birds, which is credited as the first country rock group. It's the group that influenced the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt and all those 70s country rock artists. Well, we were managing Chris Hillman and Desert Rose Band, along with Holly Dunn, who was a very successful country artist originally from San Antonio, had an appreciation for the mixing of the cultures in that San Antonio area. And the... You know, in general, it was a very logical step, seeing the similarities between Tejano and country, to branch into management of Emilio, who we thought had potential as an artist, not just in Tejano, but in country, and also extremely interested in the idea of evangelizing on behalf of Tejano music. Now, I had grown up in a home in Kansas with a Mexican-American stepfather, married my mother when I was 5 years old, and raised me. So I was the little gavacho in the middle of an extended family, which allowed me to appreciate, although I hadn't developed any fluency, regrettably, in Spanish. Not in Kansas, because it was only our family, and I grew up listening, you know, to Spanish. My abuelito, who died 2 years ago at the age of 98, never spoke English in his life. And he was from Mexico and came up as a worker for Santa Fe Railroad. And so my stepfather and uncles and a number of the members of the family were all Santa Fe Railroad workers, all Mexican-American in small towns in Kansas. So I grew up with a peripheral, you know, but very important appreciation of the culture and the music. Tapping into the music of Texas Tornadoes and subsequently Emilio brought me sort of full circle, and felt like a very, very comfortable position for me to help bridge the gap between the Anglo world and the Latino world through music. So Emilio signed to EMI for Latin recordings, but wanting to be a country artist.
He wanted to cross over, so to speak.
Wanted to cross over, and that was his first
wish.
That's
been the history of a lot of Tejano artists.
Sure.
Hoping to, you know, crash the big bucks.
Exactly. And so one of my first tasks as a manager was to go to the head of EMI in Hollywood. It was Jose Bejar, who is still the head of EMI, Latin, and ask his permission to what we call pitch, you know, to present Emilio to the country labels in Nashville for a country recording career. Now, EMI's sister label in Nashville is Capitol Records in Nashville. And the discussion was that we would have permission to do that. If Capitol Records was interested, of course, they would have first choice, being sister label. Mm-hmm. But if Capitol Nashville was not interested in Emilio, that we would then have permission to shop him at any other country label in Nashville.
You were not associated with the Arista at the time?
Not at all. I was an artist manager, and our company was called Refugee Management, appropriately enough, because we thought our artists were artistically refugees. And I had a partner named Stuart Dill, who figures into this whole equation, as you'll see, because we went to Capitol Nashville. Initially, they were not interested. They didn't understand the Tejano market. They didn't understand the significance of Emilio. So the first place that I went to shop Emilio was to the newly formed Arista Records with Tim Dubois. And Tim Dubois became a believer in Tejano music.
You mean after Capitol turned you down?
After Capitol turned him down, we went to Arista to present Emilio for signing to Arista. What happened was a new regime came into Capitol, Nashville. They did get the whole thing, and they did end up signing Emilio. But in the process, Tim Dubois had become a believer, and when he got the charter to create a new label, he wanted to create a label as an extension of Arista that would be based in Texas and that would initially focus on Tejano music in this region. And he called me to come down and set up the label. So that's a lengthy explanation for you, but I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, Clive Davis, you know, in New York, you know, leads to Tim Dubois in Nashville, which leads to the establishment of the first major label based in Texas and devoted, you know, ironically to Tejano music, because there was a tremendous amount of disappointment, quite honestly, on the part of the music industry at large down here when we announced that we were going to be pursuing Tejano music, because for many, many years, Austin had been seeking the establishment of a major record company, because that's the check writing entity. That's where all the income comes for record producer and for the bands and for the managers and artists and all those that come out as a result of records being made. And the initial perception was that we were going to set up here and either do country music like Nashville, or we were going to do rock music, because Austin is such a, you know, hotbed for alternative rock music. When we announced that we were focusing our initial efforts on Tejano music, the response was that in theory that's noble and probably politically correct to undertake, but nonetheless it's a disappointment to all those folks who thought that was a secondary form of music. So it's been a very interesting challenge for us, that because that was the response from the mainstream music community. On the other hand, there was a less than warm reception, as you can imagine, from the existing Tejano record companies, who were not happy about it, what they perceived as an outside carpetbagger.
Would this include people like Manny Guerra?
I wouldn't name any names, but
well, I'm just wondering, because I had a lengthy interview with Manny.
Exactly.
I think he works with, I forget who he's working with now. I don't remember. I'm sorry.
He's been working through Way Latina.
I guess, yeah, that's
right. And I don't know whether that is as a distribution deal. I don't know whether that's still effective or not. But you can surmise who those, you know, who those folks are. So we're in a very, you know, very interesting position for me, because on the one hand, the people who share the same musical taste with me, and both ends of the spectrum, you know, from the contemporary mainstream market and the Latino market, both ends were very skeptical and less than ecstatic. However, we had an extremely warm welcome from day one from the constituency of Tejano Music, mm-hmm. from the fans, you know, and the rank and file, the promoters, the fans, the musicians, the producers, songwriters, all those people in the industry who I call civilians, right? The civilians out there who are fans and who appreciate Tejano Music warmly welcomed us from day one.
There's a number of questions that popped in my mind, and let's see if I can get them. The first one, based on what you've been saying, is the musical distribution, whether it be Tejano or anything else, is it now pretty much in the hands of major labels? Is the day of the small labels over?
It's the prognosis is not good for small independent labels. And I'll tell you that the core of that reasoning goes to distribution. Again, it's the capacity of the record company not just to make records, but secondly to make sure that those records can be placed in record stores in as broad and far-reaching a context as possible. Using Arista as an example, we are distributed by a company called BMG.
Yeah, Kerry was telling me that.
And BMG is the Bertelsmann Music Group. It's a German company.
Is that your parent company?
That's the parent company. That's the interesting twist to all this is we are every major label has a distributor. And that's why the term major is even in use. A major label, as distinguished from an independent, means you're major if you have major distribution. If you have national or international distribution, every major
regional,
label...
regional distribution will not qualify you as a major label.
Exactly.
It has to
exactly.
be national or international.
Exactly. And the unique distinction with Arista is we not only are distributed by BMG, which is German-based and worldwide, but we happen to be owned by BMG.
And the BMG stands for?
Bertelsmann Music Group. It's an entertainment organization. Bertelsmann, BMG, owns RCA Records. They own Arista and they own BNA Records. BNA is the code, the airport code for Nashville Airport. On your luggage, you'll see okay. BNA. And so they created a country label that's been very successful with artists like John Anderson and Lori Morgan called BNA. So RCA owns those.
Just to clear something that I occasionally have thought about. In the old days, it seems to me anyway, like Capitol was the, you know, the major corporation. Columbia was the
right.
RCA and so forth. Now it seems like you always have these groups and then they have all of these diversified subgroups.
Absolutely.
Is that a more efficient way of conducting business?
It's become a response to market demand, and I will tell you.
I mean, that's happening in many businesses where you have sort of
sure,
like this.
Sure. As an example, again, I'm using BMG just because that's our company, but it's true across the board for all the majors. If you look at the Arista world, BMG, which owns us and distributes us, beneath that umbrella is Arista Records. Okay. Arista Records, just Arista, is pertinent for New York and L.A. Now, beneath Arista in the New York and L.A. world, you have predominantly rap, R&B, dance artists. And we have LaFace Records, which is a combination of producer L.A. Reid and Babyface, the two African-American producers who have come together and merged their names and created LaFace, L.A. Face Records, which is owned and distributed by Arista. But by the time the African-American rap and R&B audience goes to their record stores in the hood to buy their albums, they have no clue that that's coming from Arista, which is coming from Bertelsmann. All they know is it's associated with LaFace, with L.A. Reid and Babyface, the producers of artists like Toni Braxton and Whitney Houston. Okay, so that's distilled, you know, as you were all the way down. The same thing happens in the rock and alternative market in that corporations will have imprints, which we call these record imprints, which are four or five levels removed from the parent corporation. And that is because there is at street level, at grassroots level, often a stigma against buying what is perceived as commercial and therefore less substantive lyrically and musically product if it's coming from the mothership rather than...
They want to stay as close to the ground as possible.
Absolutely.
That's a marketing strategy.
Absolutely. So the labels have...
The understanding being that the people near the ground are the ones that know best.
Absolutely.
What's going to sell.
Absolutely.
And, rather now, than someone in Germany trying to figure out...
Trying to figure out what we're doing. I'll tell you a further example of that. We have Arista, Texas, which is an outgrowth of Arista, Nashville, mm-hmm. which is an outgrowth of Arista. Well, we have made a decision, partly based on the fact that we are moving into alternative rock music, and we've said all along that we were going to do that. When we set up the label, we said we will be doing rock music and different forms of music, but we're going to initially focus on Tejano, and the overall idea is to create a label where Latino music is treated with the same respect on the same level as country music or rock music, that it's not a separate world and separate entity corporately, but it's, you know, all able to mix on one label. But in order to present it effectively on the street, we have made a decision to go from Arista Texas imprint to Arista Latin on all of our Spanish language recordings and Arista Austin on our rock recordings.
So, like on a CD, will it say Arista Latin?
It will say Arista Latin if it's La Diferencia or Nidia Rojas or, you know, those type of... Any artist that's predominantly Spanish language.
Who do you have on board right now?
We have La Diferencia. Okay, La Diferencia was our first signing.
They're doing well, aren't they?
They're doing very well. You know, Grammy nomination for the first album for Best Mexican-American Performance. They were nominated in the category with Selena. Unfortunately for us, Vicky Carr won that category last year. But the record was very successful. We've sold a tremendous number of units, over 130,000 albums on that first album, which is outstanding for a first act. And, in the Latin music genre, 50,000 is recognized as gold, right? And 100,000 is platinum. So a very successful initial act. We also have Flaco Jimenez. You need no introduction to, but we did win the Grammy this year for Best Mexican American Performance. So I think it's extremely outstanding for the label to have been nominated on the first two releases of this label. Were each consecutively nominated, meaning it made the top five final nominations out of hundreds of albums nominated for Best Mexican American. Flaco's record won this year. We have an artist named Joel Nava, who's a tremendous singer from the Victoria area. He's in the studio right now. First single on him was very successful. His record was a mix of country.
I was going to ask you about that.
It was a mix of country and Tejano. This time, we felt like we're missing, you know, quite honestly, we missed a bit of both audiences by going down the middle. Joel really wanted to do a full-blown Tejano record this time. So we're in the studio now with Gilbert Velasquez. And Joel Guzman working on this next record.
You mentioned something very interesting, of interest to me, going down the middle. Can we discuss, and we'll get back to Arista in a moment, but I know you're very familiar with this whole scene. Is there a danger in going down the middle? What does that mean? What did you mean
well,
by that?
Well, we're dealing in a very unique region geographically and culturally in South Texas. And it's the merger of, you know, the Anglo and the Latino cultures, which is evidenced on a number of fronts, but obviously an extension of that merging is in the music. There is a combination of musical styles that work very well together in South Texas and in broad, in a more broad context in the Southwest as well, areas like, you know, New Mexico and Arizona, and to a lesser extent California. But that coexistence musically here has become very natural. And, you know, one of the prime examples of that is the extent to which country music is intermingled with Tejano music. Artists like, you know, everyone from Emilio to Ram Herrera, to David Legarza and Jay Perez, tremendous Tejano artists who have every much as equal acclaim to performing country music as they do, you know, to Tejano music. And Joel Nava follows, I think, in that tradition. He is as good a country singer as anyone I've ever heard in Nashville. And
I've heard of him, but I have not heard his music.
That's okay. We'll load you down. So when you
is he like another Rick Trevino or better?
Better, in my opinion, and I say that simply because Joel is more comfortable with the Tejano culture. Rick Trevino, I happen to know a bit about the career, and Rick Trevino was, you know, focused initially on a country career, and I think has addressed this constituency at the urging of his record company. As a marketing strategy, you know, don't leave out the Hispanic world. That was their thought at Sony Records in Nashville. There's got to be a way for us to tap into this. That was legislated, in my opinion, not from the heart of the artist or from the streets, but legislated from a record company marketing boardroom. And that's not something that we do, okay? I don't want to be critical of that, but what we're doing with an artist like Joel Nava is really the reverse. This is someone who, as an artist, has grown up speaking Spanish in the home, whose family speaks Spanish, and who sings Tejano as well as country, and has mixed them all up in his shows for years. And for that reason, we decided to be true to the live presentation of his music and do a record in that fashion, where we mixed up the Tejano with the country. And unfortunately, the country mainstream audience, you know, was not and is not going to be receptive, in my opinion, to that to any broad extent out there. The language barrier is critical.
You're talking about two different markets. When you talk about Tejano and country, you're really talking about two different markets, stylistically, the musicians can actually synthesize the two to a certain extent.
There is some common ground there. Our hope was that we could effectively turn on an Anglo country audience to this artist, and help them to appreciate the diversity here, believing at the same time that it would be less difficult for the Tejano audience to accept him. The Tejano audience, as we know, listens to Tejano music, but they also listen to country music.
Yeah, it's easy for country to sell in Tejano, but probably not easy for Tejano to sell in country.
Exactly. Now I'll tell you this.
Is that a correct?
Totally accurate. And I'll tell you this at the same time. I do not in any sense regret having attempted that with Joel's first record, which was 50-50. There were five songs in Spanish and five songs in English, all mixed in together. It wasn't side A and side B. You know, they were all mixed in together. And I don't regret that because I think that's an effort that's worth being made. And secondly, I also think that in future years, that record will be viewed as a landmark album that was ahead of its time. I stand by the quality and I stand by the concept of that, even though we had difficulty in the marketplace. As a result, we don't want to lose the chance to present Joel Nava, you know, to as large an audience as possible. So as a result, we've made a decision this time to not be as ambitious and to first build some groundwork out there and prove to the Tejano community, you know, that he is an absolutely legitimate Tejano artist. And for that reason, we've gone back in on record two and are making an album that will probably be 9 Spanish language songs, 1 English song, and 1 country song.
But this one will be geared to the Tejano market.
To the Tejano market.
And so if down the road you decide to try to market him for the country, you would then, that particular LP would be geared to the country rather than...
Right. Now, an example of what we're doing in that sense, there is an artist that we've signed. Part of the original signings when this label was set up, an artist who is now 22 years old from San Antonio named Rick Orozco. Rick Orozco came to us as a country artist, someone in San Antonio who grew up in both cultures, listening to country and to Tejano, but wanting to be a country artist. Now, the distinction between Rick Orozco and someone like Rick Trevino or Emilio is that Rick is a songwriter. His songwriting has been in English, you know, traditional country-oriented material, very much in the George Strait type, you know, very, very Texas-flavored country music. And Rick has moved to Nashville 2 years ago, has been developing and grooming as an artist and as a songwriter, and has had tremendous success initially in Nashville. He wrote, now keep in mind, this is a 22-year-old who left college in San Antonio to relocate in Nashville. He wrote the title song, the album title song, to Emilio's country crossover album, Life is Good. That song was written by Rick Orozco. At the same time, he has written a song which will be the new Rick Trevino single. And I'll have to check the title on that for you. But Rick Trevino has recorded Rick Orozco, so and Emilio has recorded Orozco. Now, I mention it for this reason. We are working on a Rick Orozco album, which will be our one offering from Arista, Texas, to the mainstream national country audience at large. He is an artist who we will be working in conjunction with Arista Nashville. Their radio promotion, their marketing staff, will market Rick Orozco through traditional mainstream country radio, okay, all in English. However, in the process of writing the songs for his album, you know, Rick is very much in touch with where he came from. He's written a collection of songs that are Spanish language or bilingual.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
He's written several bilingual songs, all country flavored, but either in Spanish, you know, lyrically or bilingual. We are so impressed with the songs that he's written, although they were not written for his country album, which will be all in English. Even though they weren't written, we have decided to collect those songs and put five of those songs out on what's called an EP, which is an extended play, smaller than an LP, which is, you know, a long play, or what we consider typically a CD or cassette is a long play. That's typically 10 songs or more. We're putting out an EP on Rick, which is the Tejano and the bilingual material, and we are servicing that to Tejano Radio. This is next month. We're doing this in June. We're servicing that to Tejano Radio and introducing Rick Orozco to the Tejano media and the Tejano industry as a country artist who happens to be very proud of where he comes from, and although he's not predominantly a Tejano artist, has something to say to the Tejano community. So that EP will be available through Tejano Radio and in the marketplace to the Tejano world probably about a year, 6 months to a year, before the full-blown country record will be there. I mean, that's just a, you know, really unique
way. So he has not done any recordings of his own. This is the first stuff that
this
he does.
The first stuff, the first stuff that you'll see.
But he'll be first. The EP will be targeted at the Tejano.
Exactly.
And then later.
And later.
The LP will come out, but that'll be in the mainstream country.
Exactly.
But again, am I correct in saying that it's easier to market country and Tejano than vice versa?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And this, I think that's very unfortunate.
The language barrier has something to do.
The language
How about
barrier.
Just, you know, let's face it. There's always been conflict between. Open in the beginning and latent, you know.
Sure.
Between the Mexicans in the Southwest and the Anglo-Americans.
Sure.
Does that in any way enter into the marketing strategies?
Absolutely. You know, it's very unfortunate, but there are strains of very subtle racism. And I think the most formidable obstacle that racism presents to us is in the context of country radio. In order for country artists of any ilk to succeed in today's market, it's not video, you know, it's not touring which makes a country artist, it's country radio exposure. And there is a tremendous distinction, I believe, between the audience for country music versus the core of radio programmers at country music who determine what those masses of millions of listeners will be exposed to. And the real challenge is getting an artist who doesn't conform to the conventional country standards, and by that I mean someone from Mexican American, you know, heritage.
Like an Orozco,
it's very difficult. Just given the last name, Emilio dropped the use of his last name.
Was that a,
That was a very deliberate market strategy, and I say that because my former partner, whom I told you would figure into all this, Stuart Dill, when I left Refugee Management to set up the Arista Texas label, Stuart Dill continued as manager for Emilio. And it was a decision mutually arrived at between Stuart and Emilio to drop the last name. But that was Stuart Dill's knowledge that the problem with racism at country radio was going to prevent an artist like Emilio with a name like Navaida.
It's a hard one to pronounce.
From ever being played. And so he's presented simply as Emilio. And I will tell you, Rick Trevino went through a similar situation in discussing use of last name as Trevino or Trevino. And there was a very deliberate, calculated
Trevino
effort to make sure that the country radio programmers knew it was Trevino, not Trevino, because even Trevino sounded foreign to these, you know, reactionary Anglo ears.
Although he had an opening already because of Lee Trevino.
Yes, right.
I think, though, they call him Lee Trevino, don't they?
Lee Trevino, yes.
Yeah.
So we're up against that with Rick Orozco, but I can assure you that he will not go by Rick. He will go by Rick Orozco, and we'll just deal with it.
I know it must be a labyrinth, or maybe, I don't know. In the old days, there used to be payola. What do companies do now to make sure their records are
payola,
played? I'm not trying to compromise.
No. What I'll tell you is, and I'll be very honest with that. I mean, payola today is obviously illegal, and it truly does not exist in the mainstream music markets. We do a lot of work in Mexico, promoting our artists in Mexico, and that's a different world down there. Payola still
figures
in.
What do you guys call down there?
Exactly. And I will assure you that, you know, we're not involved, you know, in that at all. But just as observers of that market, it's very educational to see the extent to which that controls the market in Mexico. However, it's not the case up here. And what's happened is, really, in essence, payola has shifted. The concept has remained the same. The translation into reality has changed. And instead of money and drugs and women, which was prevalent, you know, for a couple of decades out there, payola now is in the form of gratuities like tickets to athletic games, airline tickets, to showcases in places that make for fine vacation spots, flying radio programmers in and out to showcases and special events, merchandising. Those sort of things.
Well, that happens, it seems, in all, like, even outside the music. I mean, it happens in any kind of market.
Sure,
it's the same. Soap or
that's right. It's the same as washing machine
whatever
vendors. You know, working their account. You know, giving their account reps tickets to the World Series. That's the sort of thing that we're talking about. That greases the wheel in radio.
That context, Little Joe. You know, Little Joe
Hernandez. Sure,
or at least know of him. Once told me, when I was interviewing him as part of this orchestra book, he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember the exact, we were talking about Tejano music, this was, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago, and he was telling me that a big company, I think we were talking about Capital EMI or somebody like that, if they want to really push a record, they're in a position where they can make it go.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he was talking about the influence they have. So do big labels have influence?
Yes, and I'll tell you part of the reasoning for that influence is that a label like EMI Latin, which happens to be the largest in the Tejano world, they'll go in and let's say they want to get a new single by Bobby Pulido added to the radio. Their interest is in breaking this new artist, Bobby Pulido. Well, if radio likes Bobby Pulido and wants to respond immediately and play that, EMI Latin's in good shape. If there's some hesitancy, on the other hand, EMI Latin can respond, and that response can be subtle or it can be less than subtle. They have, by virtue of their size, a roster that includes Selena, Maz, Emilio, and their conversation with the station about Bobby Pulido can take the course that says, if you play Bobby Pulido for us and push this record and help us break this artist, then you'll be included in the promotion that we're putting on, giving tickets away to see Maz, Grupo Maz, on New Year's Eve,
right,
you know, in Houston. If, however, you choose not to help us with Bobby Pulido,
you'll have to pay your wages.
Your competitor, you know, may be the one that ends up with tickets to Maz. So it's that sort of influence. It's using, you know, the prestige and the allure of one artist to promote the career of another. That's the benefit that a major has.
Is Arista yet in that kind of situation where you can exert that?
Unfortunately, we're not. Now, I'll tell you simply by the size of the roster. At the same time, truly, we try to present artists whose quality musically will be the appeal. The radio will want to play our artists, and we won't need to cajole anybody into playing our artists. Now, that goes to the inherent philosophy of this label, which is, again, in keeping the Latin artists, the Latino music artists here on the same level as rock artists, we want to do very few artists. We're not going for an enormous roster. We don't want to be Sony Discos. We don't want to be Fonovisa. We don't want to be EMI Latin. That's not what we're after. We want, right now we have 7 artists, you know, compared to the 25 or 30 on those others. Yes. Okay. 7 artists total. We have, again, 4 artists right now initially in the alternative rock world. So you're talking about an 11 artist roster, 7 of whom, you know, are from the Latino music world. What we want to do is make each one of those acts as successful as humanly possible so that we don't have 15 or 20 or 25 or 30 artists on this label, none of whom are getting the attention, you know, that they need from the record company to more effectively promote their music. So for that reason, we're not probably ever going to have that leverage issue of having a number of acts on there, and we've got to be able to make records that are appealing enough that the radio station will want to play them. What we have used is a variation on that.
Is this thing still there?
We're still going, yeah.
Okay. I guess it'll just flip up when it's out, I hope, anyway.
Well, it'll click off at least. What we have used is a variation on that strategy, which is we've been very successful at our Arista Nashville label with artists like Alan Jackson and Brooks and Dunn and Pam Tillis and some of the top names in country music. We have been able, because of that relationship with our parent label, to provide tickets, backstage passes for Tejano Radio to meet the biggest stars in country music.
Well, I think that's probably.
We've been able to offer access on a level that they've never been able to do. Exactly.
You almost have to nowadays.
Absolutely.
So that's why the small labels are not in that position anymore. The Haciendas and the Freddy's.
That's right.
And records and stuff.
Right. There's very little bartering power, and you must rely on the music. Well, you know, that's the most important thing, is the making of the right type of music. However, because of the thick competition out there, you can't rely just on the music. You've got to be able to take care of people in a way that's legal and ethical.
Yeah. Let me ask you a hardball question, Cameron. Not personally directed
sure.
at you, but at the business itself. You know, when I was doing the first book, the Conjunto book, I was in the late 70s, early 80s, at the time when Tejano was still very much a localized phenomenon. I mean, there was no Selena, no mm-hmm. Maz. Mm-hmm. Maz was around, but it was a small, you know.
Right.
Inevitably, the information I got, or the impression I got, was that Tejano was pretty much homegrown and marketed.
Mm-hmm.
And the artists had a lot of freedom in terms of what they were going to do, because a small label is just not in a position to dictate. Now, a large label, say EMI Latin, does it have the potential to distort the natural development, and that is to say, the ground level development, because of its interests in expanding, you know, the parameters of that music? Does the question make sense?
Yes,
to you?
It does. I think, answering truthfully, yes, I think it has the capacity to do that. My experience and my observation in working in this market for the past 6 years is that it's the just the opposite is true. The artists that were on the small independent labels are the artists who had absolutely no say in how their careers unfolded. They had no say in the songs. When I say no say, I mean little to no say in what songs were chosen for albums and how they were performed. The grossest violations against the rights of songwriters, Latino songwriters, have been at the hands of the brethren.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The owners and the controllers of the small independent record companies are the ones who have taken advantage of their own people, not the major labels.
Yeah, I know some stories along those lines.
You know, not the major labels, and that's very, very unfortunate. But the irony to me is that with a larger record company, with the major label presence increasing in number and in diversity in this market, the standards, which have for years been applied to the general marketplace, are now becoming applied to the Tejano industry. And what that means ultimately is some light is being shined on some previously dark corners, dark recesses within this industry, and not everyone's happy about that. And, you know, if I were one of those who had been taking advantage knowingly of my own people for many, many years for my own profit, I wouldn't be happy about that either. But I have no... Let me finish that thought. Right. Intrinsically, part of what we had intended to do from day one is help apply some of those principles of the general music market to the Tejano industry. By that I mean we require our artists, when I discussed the first initial signings to this label, we require those artists to have personal, professional artist managers, not parents, not spouses, not family members, but professional artist management to represent them. We require them to have talent agency representation to get them the performances in concert that they need, okay? And not rely on, you know, the old system of working out of from the kitchen table, but to be represented on the same level as country or rock or any other type of artist out there. We also came in and voluntarily adhered to AFM union standard payments to all musicians on our recordings. That had not been done even by the major labels here, who are signatories to the union. But for years they had been getting away with paying Latino musicians less than any other group of musicians out there. They also had not paid producer advances. They had not given producer percentage point participation in the recordings. All those sort of things, which are commonly done in every other type of music, were not done in Tejano music. And we came in from day one and said, even though it's going to cost us more in the form of initial overhead to do it this way, we believe these principles need to be applied to this market.
Since you got into that, who decides your company specifically, since you're, you know, involved in it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this act is worth, I mean, do you go out and do you or someone else, a representative, listen to this group or a person and say, they're good?
Yes. That traditionally...
Run that through me, how that...
Sure, that what happens, that's traditionally the position in the record company that's devoted to scouting talent and finding and signing new talent is called A&R. That's your A&R person. And A&R is a long-standing term that goes back many, many years, which simply means artist and repertoire. And it goes from, you know, the early days in the music industry where the A&R man not only found the talent but also chose the songs.
I was on contract with Backbeat Records.
Okay.
Back in 1959, 60, 61. So I know it all.
Yeah, okay.
You remember Backbeat Records?
Sure, another name. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the A&Ring is done, typically it's done by people whose jobs are devoted exclusively to that area. At this label, because we're so small, the A&Ring is done by two of us. I do the A&Ring. I'm the ultimate signer. I'm the one who decides, yes, this is an artist that we think is worth investing in. And so I'm the one who will sign off, offer them the deal, negotiate the deal with our business affairs attorney at Arista in New York, and sign off on them. But I do this hand-in-hand with Joe Trevino, who is from San Antonio. He works with us. He'll be walking through the door any minute here. He is in charge of our artist development and promotion at radio because of the fact that Joe's responsible for getting our singles played at radio. He needs to have a say, in my opinion, in who signed to the label and whether or not that talent is ultimately going to be accessible to radio. So Joe Trevino has a full vote. Even though I'm ultimately responsible for the signings, I take a great deal of direction from Joe, and I won't sign anybody to the label that Joe and I do not agree on mutually as being somebody worth signing. Joe, to give you an idea, initially was the one who brought Ricardo Castellón and La Diferencia to my attention. Joe had been a fan of Ricardo when Ricardo had a solo deal with Manny, and felt like, you know, Ricardo was a diamond in the rough who had not been effectively presented. And that's turned out to be a tremendous payoff to us.
So they signed contracts, actually signed contracts, recording contracts?
Yes.
When I was, I used to be on that contract that I told you about. I was part of a little group, and I think we, I think we got like 3% or something of every record. So. I mean, have times changed?
Have changed, and what happens now is an artist will sign for a multiple series of contracts or recordings. That's always at the label's option. The label can decide whether or not to renew on each term. But an artist gets an initial recording advance, an artist advance up front, cash up front for signing the contract. Additional sums, you know, agreed on in advance for each subsequent record. And then the participation is typically your 3 points is now tripled. So typically you're starting in the 9 to 12 range and up. Now out of that 12, when I say 9, that's with the understanding that conventionally the producer of the album will now get 3 points. That's the standard payment to the producer. So while an artist is given 12 points initially, it's understood that 3 of those will go to the producer. So ultimately, the artist is starting out with 9 points and then goes up from there.
Is that per unit sale, or
yes,
9% of
yes
unit sales, or
yes,
whatever?
Yes, yes. And you figure into that standard number of deductions for packaging and free goods and all those sort of things. Yeah. But essentially, it's 9 points, starting at 9 points and going up.
Of course, for the musician, I would imagine the value of the contract is not so much in the money you'll make from the records, but in the exposure where you can then play concerts.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right, because the recording contract really needs to be viewed as a means to an end, because of the fact that so much is required to be recouped first. The recording costs, video costs, you know, all those sort of things that come out of the front end must be recouped before the artist ever sees any money. However, this is what artists, you know, seldom stop to think about. The recording company, the record label, gets no income from concert performances. They get no income from corporate sponsorships or from merchandising of t-shirts and hats and those sort of things. And it's the fact that an artist has a record contract and is exposed on the radio that enables the artist to make money from all these other areas.
Well, you know, it's somewhat similar in the academic business, actually. When you publish a book, like through University of Texas Press, I get about maximum 9%, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, of course, I'm not going to go out on concerts or anything
right,
like that. But
right.
After a while, you might be able to get $1,000 for a lecture if you're good enough. You
sure, sure, sure. Well, it's all synergistic, really. It's all, you know, it's all working to create an overall impression to the public of the artist, so...
I wanted to just get back to a couple of things that I had written down earlier. with traditional, you know, I've been told, as I've talked to people over the years, that what happened with the traditional conjunto like Flaco is that it evolved into something that they now call progressive conjunto, mm-hmm. which is what David Lee Garza is, mm-hmm. and I guess Emilio Navaira.
Mm, La Tropa F. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that how you see it? I mean, is there such a thing as the progressive
yes. Yes.
branch and then the traditional
yes,
branch?
Yes, I think so. And I think artists like Michael Salgado, who's becoming very successful. Are you familiar with him?
I don't think
very
so.
Very recent. You should check him out now. And I don't recall the label. It's, you know what, it's one of the smaller labels. It may be Manny or Joey. You know, I think it's Joey Records, actually, that Michael Salgado is on. But that's somebody you ought to check out because he's representative of that progressive conjunto. And I think progressive, you know, means, to be quite honest, you can analyze this in several different musical discussions. The truth is, I think it all comes back to age, quite honestly. The progressive conjunto means conjunto music played by younger people.
Yeah. Well, I think there are some different... Well, actually, you know, I am a musicologist, so I have, you know, mm-hmm. I can... And, you know, I was a professional musician for years and years. In my estimation, Cameron, I think the conjunto tradition reached its apex really in the 1960s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And some of those people were doing real great. What's happened since then is that the quality of the recordings have improved.
Sure.
But the innovation itself, it's like conjunto has been standing, you know, tilling the same ground basically. Although the progressive conjunto like Emilio, I think, bring a little different flavor to it, perhaps.
Sure.
But it's not that different, really,
sure.
from what it used to be.
When you hear a bit of the Joel Napa record, you'll hear some, you know, flavorings of progressive conjunto on that as well. La Tropa F, you know, which is sort of turbo conjunto to me. It's, you know, it's rocked up conjunto, and it's the essence is the same, but the potency has transcended what conjuntos have traditionally been able to present in concert. As well as the live recordings, you say, you know, the technology has made it that much more enhanced. But there are presentations that are simply just more powerful in concert, and I think La Tropa is a prime example. They're enormously successful in the last couple of years.
Who did they record?
They actually had 4 years been with Manny. But they left, that contract was over, and they are now at EMI. This is the first album from them on EMI Latin.
Now, La Diferencia, their music is more like that of, what, Maz?
More like Mafia, probably.
Mafia.
Mm-hmm. It's more international. It's a Tejano international.
That's for the cumbia.
Right, more cumbia flavored, exactly. Yeah. Now, the primary writer for La Diferencia is Miguel Spindola, who is from Mexico City, living now in San Antonio. But La Diferencia, true to its name, the original group consisted of three brothers from the Chicago area who were sons of a Tejano musician who had moved to Chicago. So they were raised in Chicago with blues and jazz influences. They returned to Texas and got together with Ricardo Castellon, who had grown up in La Pryor, south of San Antonio, and Miguel Spindola, who came in from Mexico City, and mixed all this up. So, you know, you've got this mix of some traditional accordion-based, but also with cumbia and international pop flavorings.
So is the cumbia the entry into the Latino market? You've got to do cumbia in order to...
The cumbia is an entry. I don't think it's not necessarily required for the Tejano world. It is required to get beyond Texas.
That's what I mean, the Latino, larger
exactly.
Latino world.
Absolutely.
Is that why Selena was really getting into the cumbia?
Absolutely. Cumbia is what opened the doors for Selena. Same thing for Emilio. Emilio's doors into life beyond Texas was initially opened by his duet with Selena. Now, that was not a cumbia. That was a ballad. Duet, but her success in cumbia enabled people to pay attention to her doing a ballad, and she did a ballad with Emilio, who was then brought to the attention of audiences in California.
I just don't see
Mexico.
Emilio doing cumbia.
And Emilio has, you know, for several years focused on breaking Mexico, and I assure you, you know, that he's worked, you know, his share of cumbias And it's considered the musical passport, you know.
Cumbias. The reason why there's a discrepancy is I see them all attired in country western, and cumbia is sort of it belongs in a different...
Slicker, you know, more dance-oriented.
Yeah.
But sure enough, it's the cumbia that's opened the door for him.
I wanted to discuss one last thing with you, Cameron. This whole business of crossover. Can you define or try to enlighten me on what people mean when they talk about crossover? And is there more than one kind of crossover?
Well, I think crossover essentially is pretty much one concept, which is crossover from a more obscure genre, more confined genre of music into a mainstream awareness or mainstream consciousness. Now, there can be more than one type of crossover in the sense that there are more than one type, obviously, of mainstream genres of music. You can cross over from a smaller type of music into R&B in a national consciousness, or into, well, if you were music like the music that's made by Arista New York, okay, Whitney Houston, Tony Braxton, you know, R&B music, all right, if there's an artist like Jay Perez who loves R&B music, okay, he's a successful, popular Tejano singer. He's done country on his records mixed in with Tejano. Yet, if you talk to Jay Perez, what he really wants to become is a Luther Vandross, you know, or, you know, an R&B artist. And my point is, you can cross from that smaller music, Tejano, into R&B, okay, if you're able to pull that off. You can do that in that music. You don't touch the country audience or the rock audience, right? But you have crossed over from this small type of music and made a big impact, and you would be the first, you know, Tejano artist to have an impact in R&B. That would be obviously a successful crossover. Now, if you're in Emilio's position, you want to do the same thing. You want to cross over from smaller, confined, regional music like Tejano, but your target is not R&B, your target is country music. So the extent to which Emilio has succeeded in crossing over is a subject for discussion, because in the country market, gold records are awarded at 500,000 units, platinum at 1 million, okay? Emilio right now is in the 200,000 unit range. Where that's considered double platinum in the Tejano world, he's less than halfway to gold in the country market. Selena, you know, represents the other end of the spectrum. Selena wanted to get from that, you know, Tejano music confines to the terrain that was traversed by Madonna and Janet Jackson.
Like hip-hop, or what do you call that?
Pop, dance.
So that would be considered a crossover.
Absolutely. The crossover process, I think you have to look at in terms of keeping a blank, okay, fill in the blank on where you wish to cross over, as long as it is mainstream music. What does mainstream mean? Let's face it, English language.
And even there's going to be many different styles.
Many different styles.
So crossover would imply...
But any one of those styles comprise markets that are huge compared to the size of the Tejano market.
So a crossover would be where you go from one small market into a larger, quote-unquote, mainstream market.
Right.
But if George Strait decided to invade the Tejano market, that wouldn't be considered crossover?
It would be a crossover in the sense that crossing over means going from one type to another. If you want to be literal about your definition, you're simply crossing over. You're going from one type to another type. However, you know, the common definition has evolved. That crossover implies, it is implicitly referencing going from a smaller to a larger. That's a crossover success, going from a little to a big.
Little market to a bigger market.
Therefore, if George Strait crossed over to Tejano, would he be crossing over? Sure. Would it mean anything suggestive of success at all? No.
Yeah.
You know?
But then it involves a crossover from a smaller to a larger market, but it also involves a stylistic crossover as
Absolutely.
Well.
I mean, that goes absolutely. Also so if George Strait did a, you know, let's say that George Strait did a duet, you know, with Emilio, in Spanish was incorporated in the lyrics, and the music was Tejano, country flavor, but Tejano. If he did a duet with Emilio or with Rick Orozco or, you know, Jay Perez or Ram, you know, one of the artists that are doing both country and Tejano. If George Strait did that duet, absolutely he would be a crossover artist. He would be considered a crossover artist. But he would be considered, ironically, regressing in the process of crossing over. It really, in other words, it really does you no good to cross over unless you're going from a smaller to a larger market.
Yeah. And one last thing, if George Strait were to try an album, a rhythm and blues album or a pop, that wouldn't be considered crossing over?
Yes.
Even though it's going from one giant market to another,
right.
It's still a crossover.
Right. The whole idea behind crossover, we have to keep this in mind, the whole idea behind achieving crossover success is your objective is to win new fans, reach a new audience. George Strait going from country to Tejano is not perceived as a success. Why? Because the Tejano audience,
already is his
even though they listen to Tejano, they're already his audience. They already also buy those records.
Yeah.
Now, if George Strait cross over to R&B, that might be considered more likely to be successful because he's going to an audience which previously hasn't bought George Strait records.
But it's a risk.
It's a risk, absolutely.
It may not be worth taking.
Absolutely.
You know, when you're at that level.
So the question becomes ultimately, in my mind, in the Tejano world, how much do we view Tejano music as a means to an end? You know, are we in danger when you are Selena and you're successful in Tejano, but your dream and your goal is to be a pop crossover, and you're Emilio and you're successful in Tejano, but your dream and your goal is to be a country star, are you by that very process reinforcing the secondary nature of Tejano music? In other words, you're saying, are you sending out subliminal message which says,
this is not good enough,
this music is fine for us Mexicans,
right,
but it's not the real deal?
Well, that brings up to mind one final question. Tejano music has historically been a regional market. I guess it still is a regional market, isn't it?
Yes.
And probably the chances of Tejano becoming a major style that you mentioned California. California mm-hmm. has some resistance to Tejano.
Tremendous resistance. And there are some there are some inroads being made there, but there's tremendous resistance. We just came back from the Billboard magazine Latin conference in Miami. And you go down and get a very sobering reminder of Tejano's place within the Latino family musically. It's still treated as essentially a blue-collar secondary genre of music that is confined to a geographical area. Now that's within the context of Latin music in general, let alone ever getting beyond that language border,
yeah,
you know, into the English-speaking market.
But what about Tejano invading, say, Mexico and Latin America? What?
I think there's every indication that's happening right now. Tejano has made tremendous progress in Mexico. It's being programmed, you know, initially Monterrey, as you would guess. Monterrey was more receptive to Tejano music. It still is more receptive to the accordion-based.
There's similarities.
The ranchera, you know, accordion-based.
Originally it was the same music.
The popularity of Selena, you know, in Mexico began in Monterrey. Same with Emilio.
Mingo Saldívar has been going
sure.
to Monterrey lately.
Sure, and Emilio is tremendously successful in Monterrey. But again, that's because so many of the music patrons in Monterrey are accessible, you know, to the States. They come back and forth across the border. They listen to what's being played in Texas. They see concerts in Texas. Less so in the interior. When you get down to Mexico City, the cumbia is still king. Nonetheless, there are radio stations all over Mexico City now that are playing Tejano music. That didn't happen even 3 or 4 years ago. So there's been tremendous progress there. La Diferencia, just for, you know, for our end of things, La Diferencia has been very successful in Mexico. They have not toured there yet. They're doing their first tour this year. But both albums have been released in Mexico. They've been down for a number of performances, you know, television. They're in Furia, you know, and a number of the popular publications out of Mexico City. Now, that's, you know, they are perceived there certainly as a Tejano act, even though they are, or in our view, more Tejano international. in Mexico, they're viewed as a Tejano act, but they have been accepted along with, you know, artists like Emilio and Selena and La Mafia as well. So yeah, there's a market, I believe, for Tejano in Mexico and South America, and I think that's much more promising and much more likely to come to fruition sooner
than, because of the language.
Because of the language, than inroads up here.
Well, I think is the major labels realizing that? I mean, along with the
Arista,
that
absolutely, hey, we have
that
signed.
Sleeping giant over there.
That's right, and that's why
that gold mine that's waiting to.
I've just come back from 3 days in Mexico City, presenting one of our new female artists to our sister company BMG. Areola is our sister company in Mexico City. We're down there camped out. You know, we're treating everything that we do up here in the A&R world, we do with Mexico in mind. When we sign an artist here, you know, it's with consideration toward how they will be accepted in Mexico.
Sounds like a pretty astute, you know.
I'll tell you later. I'll tell you later if it works.
Listen, Cameron, thanks a lot, man, for your
time. Absolutely, my pleasure.